Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History's latest bonus episode. Tom, you have been on your travels.
I have.
And we are keen to talk about Ronald Reagan. We've had so much feedback about Reagan. But you said, I want to talk about Kent.
So, I do. So I've been on a three-day tour with my dear friend Jamie Muir, who is himself a Kentish lad. Mm-hmm. But we went specifically to look for pre-Norman conquest Kent. So Iron Age, Roman, Anglo-Saxon.
Right.
And the reason for that was that there are various places that I've read so much about. I had the kind of strong sense that I wouldn't properly understand the role that they had played without actually seeing them, kind of actually going there and looking at them. So they were the Saxon shore forts that the Romans built. You know, on the North Sea coast. So there were two particular ones, Reculver and Richborough. There is the lighthouse in Dover Castle, the Roman lighthouse, which was built, you know, in the time of Claudius. So it's 2,000 years old.
Yep.
And then there are all the various churches that that mark the coming of Christianity to Kent. So Augustine, when he arrived in 597. And it just seemed insane to me that I hadn't actually been to see them. So for several years now, I've been very, very busy. Haven't had time to go off on jaunts to Kent. But this had been my plan, that I would go and see these, but also see everything else that I could that in some way touched on the theme of ancient Kent.
So just for those people who are overseas listeners, Kent, Tom, is in the southeastern corner of England and is facing... Where is Kent facing?
Well, it's facing Calais. So it's the nearest point of England to the continent.
It's the nearest point to... The Low Countries as well, though, isn't it? You're not that far from, presumably, Belgium and Holland.
Well, so it's where the Dunkirk evacuation in the war.
Yeah.
Lots of the little ships went from Ramsgate.
It did.
Which is where I was staying. You know, and there are loads of RAF bases. So there's a Spitfire base where it got so heavily bombed in 1940 that all the kind of engineers would run and hide. So the Spitfires, when they came back from flying sorties, would land, and they would just have to leave their planes on the runway, and they wouldn't be put away. And everyone would come from Ramsgate and nick all the spare parts. Apparently,
Tom, do you know, I've only ever been to Kent, I think, 2 days in my life.
Right,
so it's a long way away.
I live in London. It's actually not, I mean, it's an hour and a half away. So it just seemed mad to me that I hadn't done this. And of course, it's very much in the news at the moment because, you know, I say Kent is the east coast of Kent is England's front door. This is the point from which all the little boats who are sailing from Calais are coming over and landing there. So again, in the sense, it's kind of in the front line. And this is what makes it so interesting historically, is that again and again, this is where migrants, invaders, people have landed. And you'll remember the joke in 1066 is that if you want to invade Britain, you have to land at the Isle of Thanet.
That's right,
And the Isle of
Hengist
Thanet.
Hengist and Horsa.
But well, we'll come to them. So the Isle of Thanet, back in ancient times, right the way up to the Middle Ages actually, was literally an island. So if you imagine... the southeast point of England, it kind of sticks out into the sea towards France. And the northeastern point of that was an island. And there was a channel separating that island from the mainland called the Wantsome Channel. And Reculver and Richborough were two forts that the Romans built to control access to the channel. And Richborough was the great gateway to Roman Britain. They built a huge triumphal arch there. It was probably where Claudius's base was. For the invasion of Britain. Julius Caesar landed a few miles down the coast at Walmer, and there's a kind of little sign claiming this is where he landed.
Sign?
Yeah, it's a little kind of a block of stone with a picture of Julius Caesar wearing a laurel wreath on the beach.
The kind of thing you would drag me to for hours.
I would, absolutely.
That's all there is.
Absolutely. So the Isle of Thanet is, you know, it's key for Caesar's invasion, it's key for Claudius's invasion. It's also, as you said, it's where Hengist and Horsa, who are reputedly the Saxons who get invited by Vortigern, the High King of Britain, to come and serve him as mercenaries with calamitous consequences. It's where they're said to have landed. And brilliantly, Dominic, I thought of you. In 1949, so this was the 1500th anniversary of the supposed landing of Hengist and Horsa on Pegwell Bay by Ebb's fleet.
Right.
So just south of Ramsgate. A crew of Danes came over in a long ship to England and landed there to market. And the ship is still there. So we went to see it.
Oh, wow.
The reason I thought of you was that it featured, that there was kind of Pathé news footage of them arriving.
Yeah.
Here come the Danes landing to mark this historic occasion, all that kind of stuff. But that footage was then used in an episode of Doctor Who, an early episode of Doctor Who in 1965.
Was it? Which one?
It was a kind of episode. It was an episode about Vikings.
The Time Meddler.
Could be.
Where a rogue Time Lord called the Monk tries to change the result of the Battle of Stamford Bridge with laser guns.
Yes. Okay. So, yes. So it would have been that.
I know.
So
they used
that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so you should go and see this. But
well,
also,
it's a long way to go.
But also, the other great thing about this very spot is it's also where St. Augustine landed, who'd been sent by Gregory the Great in 597 to convert the English. And he then went on to Canterbury. And this was the other thing I wanted to see, was the very, very complicated history of how all the various churches that were planted in Canterbury, how they, you know, what order they came in. So the oldest church, the oldest church, extant church with continuous services in the English-speaking world is outside Kent. It's called St. Martin's. And it was probably there before Augustine came. So Bertha, who was the queen of Athelbert of Kent, a Frank, was Christian. Right. This is one of the reasons why Augustine wanted to come and why Gregory the Great sent him there. And this church is still standing, and a portion of it, the kind of the oldest portion of it, is probably a Roman mausoleum. So going back to the days of the Roman Empire, the last days of the Roman Empire, this kind of square. So that's incredibly eerie. This is the oldest church in the English-speaking world. But that cube of it takes you back to the Roman Empire, the days of the Roman Empire. So the sense of antiquity is, well, Dominic, it's dizzying.
Dizzying.
I was unbelievably moved. And then there's another church by the Abbey, and then you can kind of track the course of it, and then you end up ultimately in with Canterbury Cathedral. So it was a great trip. And the Saxon Shore Forts are superb. The Roman Lighthouse is superb. You walk in and you're inside a 2,000-year-old building.
Yeah.
These churches were great, but there were also kind of other stuff that I would so have enjoyed taking you. So there were a lot of Roman mausoleums that had been turned into churches in fields, kind of outside Faversham and places like that.
There's a lot of trudging across fields, basically.
There was quite a lot of...
Yeah.
No, joyous gambling.
Right.
God. So anyone with any interest in early English history, I can't recommend it highly enough, because probably the number of interesting sites and locations is higher there than anywhere else in the country. Perhaps, you know, almost as high maybe as anywhere in Europe.
That is a vast claim for you to make there, Tom.
If you're interested in Roman and Anglo-Saxon, and indeed Norman, then obviously it's the place where there's the highest concentration of historically significant places, because this is where they all landed.
Right. Crikey. So people who don't follow you on Twitter, if they go to your Twitter feed, they can see, because you did this colossal thread, didn't you?
Yes,
all
I did.
The photos and all the places. So people are interested in that, even if you're not in Britain and you're just interested in checking it out.
The thing is that it's the amount of stuff from the Roman and the immediately post-Roman period, which seems so dark to us, that actually is just kind of littered around. So there's a cross that came from, so Reckelver was a Roman fort. It's falling into the sea. So there was a church on it, because it had been a monastic site, and then this monastery had been converted into a church, and the church was on the verge of falling into the sea. So it got disassembled. And there was a cross there that may well have dated back to 7th century, maybe even earlier than that.
Mm.
So the very beginnings of Christianity in England, and chunks of that are in a library in Canterbury. So we wrangled an invitation to see that.
Yep.
And there are pillars from Reckelver that were Roman. So they'd come from the Roman fort, been used in the church. They got demolished and they're in the crypt of Canterbury. And this sense of the kind of the litter of time just being scattered in obscure churches and libraries all over Kent is really fabulous.
Very good.
Very exciting. Very exciting.
So, Tom, I was talking of monotheistic religions. Mm-hmm. One of our listeners, Andrew Clark, who is a man with whom I once went on a stag do to Minsk.
Oh, yes. And you ate, what was it? Chocolate. Awful chocolate.
Very bad chocolate.
Yeah.
And bad choice of pizzas. Pizza with the owner, pizza with the devil. special pizza.
That's right.
They were the three pizzas they had. He asked us a question. He said, were either of us intending to see the production by the English National Opera of Akhenaten, Philip Glass's opera based on the Egyptian pharaoh? And as it happens, that's what I did this weekend.
And what did you think?
I hadn't seen it before.
That's Philip Glass, for anyone who hasn't heard the opera.
That's kind of, that was a bit of yodeling music, Tom. That was like yodeling.
Well, he does yodel, doesn't he? Because he's Akhenaten himself, his countertenor.
His countertenor, exactly. So I thought it was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And it made me think a lot about, I thought it was brilliant at capturing the strain. Well, I mean, it's a very strange piece of work. The music is beautiful. But I thought in its straight, I liked the fact that it was so strange, because I thought that captured how strange the world of ancient Egyptian religion would be to us, actually. And I love the fact that it reproduces so many, I mean, basically all of it is sources, isn't it? It's all texts. Sort of the hymn to the Aten, or fragments of coronation rituals. And then at the end, bizarrely, an excerpt from the Fodor's Guide to Egypt. You remember that bit at the very end? Somebody reads out and says, you have to drive 8 miles, cross the river, and blah, 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 blah. So we should talk about Ronald Reagan. The day we're recording this, Monday, the final episode has gone out to the civilian listeners, the non-club members.
Yeah.
So the big sort of takeaway from Ronald Reagan, Tom, is your amazing performance.
Oh, it's really nice. Really nice. That, because, you know, there have been a few holdouts who haven't appreciated the caliber of my impersonations, but I feel this has been great. I felt like somebody being given an Oscar.
Right, like Michelle Yeoh.
Like Michelle Yeoh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It's odd, isn't it? Because when we first talked about doing Reagan, you just made a noise. when you made that noise, I thought, oh, God, he's got Reagan down to a T.
Oh.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
Very good. I mean, if the history doesn't work out.
Well, the thing is, Reagan's voice was obviously a key part of his political talents, wasn't it?
It was.
And you just have to listen to him, and everything somehow feels a bit better.
Yeah. I always think there's a gossamer thin dividing line between any appearance by Ronald Reagan and an advert for Werther's Originals.
But I mean, he did adverts, didn't he? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
He advertised cigarettes, Chesterfields.
Yeah, he did, but which he didn't smoke. So a couple of questions. So Sam sent in loads of questions, but there are two or three things that people brought up. So one is about... lots of people asked about Reagan and Thatcher. We barely mentioned Mrs. Thatcher at all, which surprised people because they were expecting us to mention her. Tom, you were, you know, coming of age, I suppose, in the 80s politically. Mm-hmm. When you think back as a sort of, as a punter, their images are quite different, weren't they? Don't you think her image was much more abrasive than Reagan's?
I'm trying to remember, living in Britain, my sense of Reagan was entirely mediated through the Cold War.
Right.
And the sense of him as someone who might precipitate a nuclear war was quite high. We mentioned the poster, didn't we, that she said, take me to the ends of the world. And he said, I'll try.
Yeah, I'll organize it.
And they said, you know, they were very much allies on that.
Mm.
But the Falklands did slightly complicate that sense that they were absolutely born allies, because there was the tos and fros of, what's his name, Al Haig.
Yes, that's right.
Secretary of State. The sense that Reagan wasn't perhaps swinging behind Thatcher to quite the degree that I'd anticipated that he would was a kind of, it was my first experience of the fact that obviously America is in it for America.
Yeah.
You know, America's interests always come first. British interests could cheerfully be sacrificed if needs be. I mean, in the end, America did basically kind of row in behind Britain, but that was kind of an eye-opener. The Reagan-Thatcher thing was essentially the idea that they were cold warriors together.
Yeah.
That was the focus of my interest in Reagan as a kind of teenager.
They definitely saw themselves, I think, as partners in a common political project. And the Cold War was a huge part of that, but also a sort of rolling back the state. You know, they sounded a lot of the same rhetorical themes. They'd met before she became prime minister. But it's interesting that people always think that their economic programs were the same, but they were quite different. And I mean, they had similar sort of enemies, and they both liked deregulation, they both liked low taxes and things. But when Mrs. Thatcher went to Washington, her first trip when Reagan was president, I mean, Reagan's press secretary had literally handed out a sort of communique to all the press saying, these are the 10 reasons why economic policies completely different from Margaret Thatcher's, because at that point she was seen as a disaster.
Yeah, you know, kind of Liz Truss-esque.
I was just going to say Liz Truss-esque. She was seen as Liz Truss-esque, and the administration absolutely went out of their way to say we are not doing Thatcher-style economics. But the difference is that in the long run, their economics is very much kind of jam today, jam tomorrow, you know, low taxes, but we'll borrow the money to make up the shortfall. Hers was kind of gruel today, gruel tomorrow, suck
it
up.
A bit of jam in 1987, in time for the election.
Yeah. So they're very different, but also I think their styles were so different. Mrs. Thatcher was so confrontational, both in private and in public. So if you read anything or talk to anybody who knew her, they will say, basically, she got up at sort of, she went to bed at 2 a.m, got up at 3, and spent all the intervening period just haranguing people and arguing with them.
Or writing letters to Emlyn Hughes.
Yeah.
Congratulating him on winning the FA Cup.
Right, exactly. But she was, you know, she was annotating every document, obsessively sort of revising the details of things. So when she had a meeting, she was insistent that she had to be as well prepared as anybody. You know, very much the sort of the dutiful, the sort of Hermione Granger, for those people who like Harry Potter, the school SWAT, basically, who's a bit of a know-it-all. And if she doesn't know it all, she's worked ferociously hard to kind of compensate.
I mean, I don't want to, well, you know, I love a bit of cod psychology.
Yeah, let's do it.
Do you think the fact that she was a woman influenced that?
Definitely. Huge. Definitely. I mean, when we do podcasts about her, that is one of the single most important things. I mean, a guy called Robin Butler, who was her cabinet secretary, said of her, he said, the thing no one gets about her is that she was a woman in a room, usually the only woman in the room, often the only person in the room who hadn't been to public school.
Right. So there's class as well as, class, as gender.
There was gender. And everybody thinks she's boring and dutiful, the little kind of northern chemist, whatever. Whereas we're all, you know, we were in the Bullingdon Club.
Well, no, to be fair to them, they were all war heroes.
They were, of course. But that gives you yet another dimension to it, right? But they're literally part of clubs that she can't belong to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where they go when the meeting is over and she can't go. Reagan goes into his meetings. He is the most popular, the best looking, the most gregarious. You know, he doesn't need to do the work and he doesn't do it. I mean, that's the funny thing. So I think there's a massive difference in temperament. But yeah, she is so confrontational. So she will argue the whole time. All Reagan's aides say of him, he will not fire anybody. He hates arguments in front of him. He doesn't like it temperamentally. But also I think in public, he does sometimes put the boot in, like he put the boot into hippies when he was governor of California, or he puts the boot into the Soviet Union. But it's not his favorite thing to do, whereas it is her favorite thing to do.
Somebody on the Discord, and I apologies for not remembering who it was.
Yeah.
Oh, I've just found it was Simon Girdleston. One question that struck me was something I heard raised by his younger son, Ron Reagan Jr., who doesn't share his father's political views. He said that his father often saw groups of people as villains or deserving of their fate, be that communists or people on welfare or people with AIDS. But when he was able to see people from that group as individuals rather than part of some collective group he opposed, be that the African-Americans he invited to his home as a young man, Rock Hudson, or perhaps even Gorbachev, he was able to view them in a very much more sympathetic and empathetic light. So the moment it became someone who was in front of him or someone he could put a name to, then he found it much harder.
Oh, right. That's interesting. Yeah.
And that might be key to some of the paradoxes and the contradictions in his career. So when he's thinking of the Soviet Union as the evil empire, he's all in. But the moment he's in front of Gorbachev sitting on a chair, you know, sitting on a sofa together, then it's different.
His instinct is to try to charm him.
Yeah.
I mean, that thing we quoted, didn't we, where he said at one point, I'd love to just get together with I mean, this is when Andropov or somebody was leader. I'd love if we could just get together and I could show them.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is that all through the 80s, she really actually thought that he was wobbly on the Soviets. She always was worried that he would, you know, when they got into a meeting together, he would just dissolve into a giant pot of treacle and give away all their advantages. The funny thing, actually, one other thing is that when he went to his first big summit meeting, everybody was very rude to him. So it was like the G7 or something. And I think Pierre Trudeau, who was the Prime Minister of Canada at the time.
Father of Justin.
And he was in his final sort of stages of his various kind of Canadian premierships. Pierre Trudeau absolutely despised Reagan. And he publicly kind of humiliated him, was rude to him, laughed whenever he spoke, kept telling him how shit his employment figures were. And Mrs. Thatcher told Trudeau off in front of all the others. And she said, Pierre, you're behaving very badly. You know, Ron is new here. was thing. And Reagan apparently was sort of sitting there, sort of bewildered and a bit upset by all this. And he really was grateful to Thatcher because she bailed him out in front of Mitterrand, Schmidt, all these just this. I always think those summit meetings would be brilliant plays,
comedy,
you know, but yeah, brilliant comedy plays,
like The Crown or something. Yeah,
exactly, exactly.
A kind of James Graham play. But on the theme of why we didn't really talk about Thatcher,
yeah,
she's not really that important.
No,
relative to all the other themes. I mean, seen from Britain, of course, it's, you know, it's the thing that we're all interested in, but standing back, I mean,
yeah,
she's probably the most significant, after Gorbachev, the most significant foreign relationship that Reagan has, I would guess. But I mean, she's way, way behind Gorbachev.
Agreed. Although Gorbachev only comes in right at the end, actually. He and Gorby are only an item for 3 years.
But it's a big story.
It is a big story, right?
It's a big story. So what was the other? You said, so that was one.
The very next question that Sam has dug out, Sean Barnes, what would Reagan think about Donald Trump? Now, some people on the Discord said, you were too soft on Reagan. Reagan opened the door to this terribly poisonous politics and all these kinds of things. My answer to that would be that Reagan and Trump are very different political personalities. Of course, anybody on the sort of right of the spectrum is bound to sound slightly different themes. So Reagan, by the way, did use the phrase, make America great again. But I don't think that's a
gotcha.
No, because I don't think that's a slogan. And I mean, that's what any opposition leader generally says. So I think Clinton said it in the early 1990s. But I don't think that means that they're inevitably all tainted. I think he's much less... I mean, he's still quite polarizing, but he's obviously nowhere near as polarizing as Trump. He doesn't identify scapegoats as much, but also...
Well, Trump is cruel.
Yeah, Reagan...
Reagan was never cruel.
No, I mean, he would tell his welfare queen story, and I think that's generally very poorly regarded these days.
But his humor, I mean, his humor was not cruel, whereas Trump's humor is cruel. I mean, the thing that they have, they're both quite funny.
Yeah.
Trump's humor is... very dark, very cruel,
yeah.
Very bitter, very savage,
yeah.
And I think that's unsettling. Whereas Reagan's humor was always kind of comforting, reassuring.
Agreed.
I think, well, as you say, a great dollop of syrup.
I think if you think about Reagan, Shining City on a Hill, all that stuff, the story that he told in his first inaugural about the bloke buried at Arlington, compare that with Trump's inaugural where he talks about American carnage.
Yeah.
And sort of burned out cities and all that. I mean, they're just, their outlook's completely different.
But also, Reagan's last speech, which is basically a kind of paean to immigration and the role that it's played in making America great.
Yeah.
Whereas Trump is all about building walls.
Yes. And Reagan actually specifically says there's a door and people can get through and we'll continue to welcome them or something along those lines, doesn't it, in that final speech. I think the broader argument is that they both represent a trend, which is the Republican Party becoming much more Southern, becoming more evangelical, becoming more, I suppose, overtly nationalistic, maybe, for want of a better word. But I think that didn't take Reagan to do that. So, I mean, don't forget there was Nixon before Reagan, who's sounding a lot of populist kind of, you know, the center against the coasts kind of theme. So all that would have happened irrespective of Reagan. And I think Reagan is a product of that as much as he is a sort of architect of it. The other thing we've got lots of comments about was Jimmy Carter.
Just on the Trump point.
Yeah.
One other point of comparison or perhaps evolution is the background that both of them have in entertainment.
Yeah.
Reagan does not turn the White House into Hollywood. He brings the methods of Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
his ability to give a speech, to tell a story, to perform a role. But that role is not determined by roles that you would get in Hollywood. Whereas Trump, it seems to me, basically turned politics into a form of show business.
Well, that's really interesting, Tom, because in the 80s, people said exactly that about Reagan.
I know they did, but I think that Trump shows how that evaluation isn't true.
Right. Well, here's something that would bear out what you were just saying. Reagan ultimately is a very effective, pragmatic politician. So when Reagan's governor of California, I mean, he starts with this great joke, I've never played a governor, I don't know what to do. But then actually he governs California in a perfectly effective kind of center-right way.
Yeah.
Again, when he's president, the same thing, that ultimately you can actually put aside the Hollywood stuff, and that when you get down to the paperwork and what they do, he is a conventional president. Trump was utterly unconventional, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he didn't do all those things that people thought, which is that he would be tamed by the office. Quite the reverse.
I mean, Reagan does have an heir in Zelensky, I would have said, who likewise kind of raised in TV and, yeah. and acting and has brought the lessons that he learned both from acting but also playing particular roles, so that, you know, the
servant of the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To what he's doing. But no one would look at Zelensky and say, oh, he's just, you know, he's just an actor now.
No.
Because he's outgrown that. Whereas Trump, the kind of the sense of controlled scripted chaos that you get, say, in wrestling.
Yes.
That I mean, a wrestling match was basically what the White House became during his term.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. The other thing we got lots of comments about was Jimmy Carter. Was he a bad president? Were we too dismissive of Jimmy Carter? Jimmy Carter, of course, is now in a hospice. So people are feeling very sort of well-disposed towards Jimmy Carter.
But also, he had a great post-presidency, didn't he? Yeah. I mean, he really did astonishing things and a great force for good.
Yeah. And as I said to somebody in the Discord, I've met Jimmy Carter, Tom. He's the one president I've met.
And he was charming?
He was very charming. He was incredibly old even then, and that was like 20 years ago. he was very charming. He was very gracious. He said to me, what do you, you know, he went around this sort of big reception. He asked everybody what they were doing. And I said, I was writing a book about the 70s. And he sort of chuckled and he said, oh, you know, a memorable decade or whatever. I wonder if I'll be in it. And I felt awful because I thought, you are in it, but you're presented very badly. But I think lots of people sort of said, oh, you're very mean to Carter. He was right about lots of things. His so-called malaise speech in 1979 was, you know, prescient because he was talking about US energy dependence and conservation and all these things. My counter to that would be that you can be right about lots of things and indeed incredibly prescient, but you can still be politically a bit useless.
Yeah.
And
fair point.
I mean, Carter's fascinating because he anticipates so many things that are to come. So he couldn't have won in any other year but 1976, post-Watergate. He's a Southerner. He's evangelical. He is a pure populist. I mean, if you read his speeches and things in 1976, he's a citizen, ordinary father, churchgoer, Sunday school class taker, who's running against Washington, against the corruption of the old establishments and all that. And of course, what that means is that when he gets into power, he finds it really difficult to govern because basically all the Democrats in Congress.
Well, he's got to sort out the tennis courts, hasn't he?
Well, he has got to sort out that. He's a terrible micromanager. An American political scientist called Byron Schaefer, 30 years ago, said to me at a conference or something, we were talking about Thatcher and Reagan or something, and he said, Thatcher's nothing like Reagan. He said, Thatcher is like a combination of Nixon and Jimmy Carter. And actually, Carter.
That's really good.
It's from a kind of low church background. He doesn't go in, you know, he bans alcohol in the White House, but also the micromanaging. And one of the things that makes him a bad president is that he's exhausted the whole time because he's reading everything. And he sees the complexities and everything because he's clever. And that means he can't ever make a decision.
Paralyzed.
Paralyzed. Absolutely paralyzed. Yeah. Exactly. And he feels everything too deeply. So the hostage crisis, I mean, obviously the way to deal with the hostage crisis in retrospect would have been to downplay it.
Yeah.
To say, you know, we'll sort it out. It's not important. Yeah. I mean, you can never claim it wasn't a big deal because it was a massive media furore. But he personalized it. He agonized. He was always there being photographed in his cardigan, looking incredibly haggard, kind of, you know, tears in his eyes or whatever.
Also, he shouldn't have gone for runs, should he? There's a warning there for everybody.
He never should have gone for runs, Tom. He should have always worn a suit. If you Google Jimmy Carter Oval Office, he's always wearing knitwear, looking like he's...
But then he was president in the 70s. So
of course
you've got to cut him some slack.
Well, it was that classic... So here's where Carter's really interesting. So I asked you at the end of the Reagan episodes about Reagan and the Romans. I mean, it was a slightly ludicrous way to be. I was trying to be inclusive at the end there.
It's very kind of you.
but Carter is a populist who has the difficulty of what do you do as a populist when you suddenly have the trappings of office? And Carter just kept up the populism. So he did fireside chats in his cardigan. He never ever, you know, he did a sort of a François Hollande or something. He never ever changed parts. He could only play that one role. And actually, he never ever grasped, I think, that what Americans want from their president is the president to be a king. Don't you think?
Which Reagan did.
Which Reagan absolutely did. I mean, as Tip O'Neill said, he'd have been a great constitutional monarch. Yeah. You quoted that, didn't you? And I think that thing about sort of George Washington didn't want to be called, though people did call him, I think, at first, Your Highness or something like that. And although they did away with those trappings, deep down, the president had always had to be the commander-in-chief. You know, Clinton had the same grief in the 90s. People sort of said he's you know, he's just eating pizza all the time and, you know.
But Clinton had charisma, though.
Yeah.
That you might want in a monarch.
Jimmy Carter, you're saying Jimmy Carter didn't?
I don't think Jimmy Carter had any charisma at all.
No, not really.
Which is why he's such a good ex-president. Because all his many manifold qualities, you know, his moral drive and his desire to do good.
Yeah.
As an ex-president, that's perfect.
Yeah, I agree. He would have made a great Mother Teresa. Whereas Gerald Ford, so I like Gerald Ford much better because I think he was a very good president, but very uncharismatic, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
But I like uncharismatic politicians. So Gerald Ford is in this sort of little, he's in my box with Jim Callaghan and Stanley Baldwin. I like stolid,
yeah.
You know, sort of the soul of the sort
soul of,
soul of the nation. Yeah. The sort of people who would read the Reader's Digest, actually.
Yeah, so we had a question about that from Klaz. Question about Reader's Digest, though. Why did it become such a thing for Reagan?
Yeah.
It did what it said on the tin. It kind of gave digests of books.
Yes.
So, you know, Madame Bovary in six pages or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It would also have loads and loads of articles about, as I remember, kind of quite a lot of things about South American birds.
Right.
That kind of thing.
I think the example you gave in the podcast
was dams in Africa.
Sort of that 1950s, 1960s improving article, which is sort of a new water filtration plant has opened in Addis Ababa.
So you can imagine poor Jane Wyman.
Yeah.
Well, look at this, Jane. Yeah. They've built a new dam in the Mekong.
Yeah. But with this sort of small C conservative and often probably quite big C conservative mindset, I think, that was sort of not necessarily massively overt in a partisan way, but it was just sort of implicit. Here are the great books of all time, abbreviated. Here are important articles about business leaders in South Korea.
Yeah.
There's some excellent stories about big game hunting. All that sort of thing.
Win 5 fridges, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's enough Reagan.
Okay.
I think we've done Reagan.
All right.
We are actually about to record another episode on an aspect of American history that's not a million miles away, the fall of Saigon, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
So I, after a hard day flogging around the ancient sites of Kent, I watched the Ken Burns.
Oh, you watched it? That I recommended?
Yes.
The last episode?
Yes. It's a great story.
What did you think?
I loved all the stuff about the fall of Saigon itself.
Yeah.
Kind of great footage and interviews.
Yeah.
But then it all became a bit dull, I thought.
The stuff about the memorial is very boring, isn't it? Don't you think?
The stuff about the memorial was moderately interesting, but it was loads of very fat American politicians going over to Vietnam and posing with very, very thin Vietnamese people looking like
Roald Dahl characters or something.
very, very Roald Dahl vibe about the whole thing. And just looking enormously pleased with themselves. Whereas I'd been hoping that there would have been a bit about, you know, Taxi Driver or...
Yeah. No, Ken Burns doesn't really do that. So if you were mocking Ken Burns, you would say, well, which is a Brit, I mean, you're sort of tempted to do.
Very easy to do.
Yeah, because it's kind of very, there's always the slight hint of lachrymosity about any Ken Burns documentary and the sort of piano music in the background and the slow close-ups on photos.
It's a ponderous film.
Well, that series. So I always think one of the biggest differences between Britain and America is the American, I don't know what American listeners or indeed our British listeners will make of this. The British instinct is always to undercut, is always to ironize things. And the American instinct is always to inflate and to make more grand, more significant. So Ken Burns did his Vietnam documentary and the BBC said, well, they were delighted and they wanted to show it. But they insisted that all the episodes be cut hugely.
Well, I can absolutely see. I mean, I would have, because you said get the American version, so I did. But the final 50 minutes was just...
Yeah, I think in Britain that would have been cut completely. The sort of
the flag had come down. The dream of liberty, however, was not wholly dead.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff.
It's always that. So that's exemplified by the difference that British and American people talk about journalism, right? So Americans talk about journalism as an immensely honorable calling, a sacred profession, the torch of truth.
That's because of Watergate, isn't it?
No, but it predates. It's not just because of that. Whereas British people, if you ever talk to a British journalist, they say
sleazy hacks.
Yeah, it's tomorrow's chip wrappers. It's worthless. It's all just a great laugh. You know.
Well, I'm very much with Britain on that.
I think we both are, Tom.
Yeah.
Right. On that bombshell, we are going to go and record loads of episodes today. So we're doing East Germany with Katja Hoyer, which is, she's written a wonderful book, Beyond the Wall, which we will be talking about in about 20 minutes with Katja. And then we're doing The Fall of Saigon. And then we've got all kinds of treats to come. So are we doing the first abolitionist next week?
Yes, Benjamin Lay.
Can't wait for that.
So we've got that to come. And then we've got the Hundred Years' War. And I was very inspired. Dominic, I Canterbury Cathedral, I saw the tomb of the Black Prince.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the place where Thomas Becket was cruelly cut down.
Yeah, I did see that, but that's nothing to do with the Hundred Years' War.
No.
But it's the Black Prince.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. So that's an inspiration. So basically, the next 2 weeks, I'm going to Amsterdam to see the Vermeer.
Are you?
So that's very exciting. Yeah. Next weekend. But aside from that, it's non-stop Hundred Years' War for me.
Good. Great. Mm-hmm. Glad to hear it. All right. Tom, we should go. You go and read up about the Hundred Years' War. I should go and...
Well, no, we're doing East Germany, aren't we, with Katja? Yeah, but after that,
actually, that was just a conceit. It was just conceit for the listeners. It was patter. Yeah,
it was just
my hospital radio, hospital radio patter.
Aha.
Right. On that bombshell, goodbye.
Bye-bye.